Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest lived in paradise from the age of 6 months, but in 2018, the campfire destroyed his family home. Ibi Liebenberg is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation and a firefighter for the state of California. He has an MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts in Poetry and Fiction and is a lecturer in the English department at Chico State University. Ibi Liebenberg has now published a book-length collection of poetry, Birds at Night, that explores themes of loss, trauma, PTSD, and familial relationships. Ibi Liebenberg, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your first name is unusual, so people are probably going, what did she say?
Yeah, it's I get asked that a lot, but it's pretty much just made up. I guess my dad was pretty creative, so he just, I don't know if he took syllables from the last name and put them together or you know, a few letters from the last name and put it together or what he did, but.
Well, you are a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, but neither your first name nor your last name come from that language. So I was wondering, enrolled citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, how is that possible?
Well, my father was German, his parents came from Germany, and, you know, he was born here. So, but on my mom's side is the Chickasaw roots, so.
Well, when I was younger, I had a cousin who worked for Chickasaw State Park, and the Chickasaw State Park is not in California. And I don't think most people, who, even if they're familiar with Native American tribes in California, may have even heard of Chickasaws. What, in California?
Yeah, well, they're from Oklahoma, Mississippi originally, and then our family, my mom's side of the family, migrated to California during, you know, the Grapes of Wrath time, the Dust Bowl era, and then, you know, there's actually a big population of rerouted or rerouted Chickasaws in Northern California, but the tribal headquarters is in Oklahoma.
Yeah, because I have seen maps of the various tribes. There were a lot of tribes that experienced the Trail of Tears. And it just, it's heartbreaking to hear what was done to these tribes.
Yeah, and it's one of the tribes is the Chickasaw Nation out of the five. But there were so many forced relocations all through United States, you know. So that's just the main one that's, you know, kind of heard of.
I lived for a while in the Appalachian Mountains in a valley called Enota. So I know one word of Cherokee, because the Cherokees lived in this enchanted valley, Enota. Mm. Now, your book has some Chickasaw words in it.
Yeah.
And I wondered, do you know Chickasaw?
I know a little. It's, you know, it's a lot of work. And, you know, I'm trying to learn a little bit at a time. So.
Well, speaking of this. You have a poem about wolves and coyotes in Chickasaw. And the very cover of your book, there is a canine. And I'm wondering, after I read your poem, well, is that a wolf or a coyote?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it's a wolf. But it's, like you said, it's the play on learning the language myself, finding words that meant the same thing. And not only that, in the poem mentions the word Ophi, which is dog. And I was able to find out through a few, I've done a few workshops, and one of the individuals there was named Ophi. And I asked them, does that mean, but they were Choctaw. So I asked them, if does that mean the same thing in Chickasaw and Choctaw? And it did, because I mean, they're closely related tribes. So mm-hmm.
I've seen maps, of course.
Yeah.
With Choctaw, Chickasaw. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, would you read that poem? And the title of the poem is Same Word in Chickasaw for Wolf and Coyote. Yeah.
Same word in Chickasaw for wolf and coyote. So my brother Neshoba calls me Ophi, the dog, spirit wrong, half wolf, half coyote. He says he would still call me dog if I was all coyote. Even if Mother Neshoba made me full wolf, he said I'd be wolf artificial, a stray handful of fur from my neck in his grip.
And this is my guest, Ibi Liebenberg, reading from his collection of poetry, and the title of the collection is Birds at Night. And this poem included some words in Chickasaw. You tell this in the first person. You say, my brother calls me. And a lot of times when I'm reading your poems, I mean, I never classify, I hadn't until now, poems as being fiction or nonfiction. But your poems, I thought, I think this is nonfiction. I think these things are true.
Yeah, it's really interesting because that's something with poetry. You know, a lot of people assume it's true, but you, like you said, it can be fictitious. I just wrote a poem about an ivory-billed woodpecker, and it's in the persona of the woodpecker.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so it is, it's hard not to assume that the speaker is the author and that it's all true, so.
Well, I think you could tell true, like, I assume that these words that you're talking about being in Chickasaw, that part is true, even though your character may be fictional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect, yeah.
Well, there's another poem that along these same lines, and we mentioned the migration, and you have a poem about the Chickasaw migration story. And this, again, this is, it's heartbreaking to read about what we did, and I think until now, we aren't told much about it. So would you read, it's called Blankets and Bones?
Yeah, Blankets and Bones, Chickasaw Migration Story. The pole leans toward a rising sun and another day of walking. The warm glow has not yet topped the trees, and my legs are already tired. Woman with child and the others too small, so I carry one and our belongings. Blankets and the bones of my mother and son tied to my back hold me together. Our rest is beyond each step and a new home every morning.
This is Ibi Liebenberg reading from his collection of poems, newly published, Birds at Night. And this story is also told in the first person. But who is this person speaking in this poem?
Yeah, and that's the thing, and it's almost like a persona poem, you know, because it's obviously not me, but being able to, I think, you know, a lot of poets are very empathetic, so you put yourself in the shoes of, you know, ancestors or whatever it is to kind of, you know, feel that pain and wonder what, you know, it was like in, for them, so.
That's why your poems evoke, at least for one reader, me, evoke emotion. And that's why your poems are, you draw on your background, and I'm wondering for this one, did you have any stories of maybe any of your ancestors who made this migration?
I just fortunately for our tribe, I mean, we have our own publication company, and so there's a lot of literature, so you're able to read other people's stories, other histories, and, you know, I just try to read as much as I can. So it's so helpful to, you know, to have that available and to, you know, draw on that, you know, other people's experiences and histories as well. So,
well, I did mention that your poems have been previously published in a lot of different publications. This one that you just read was also published in the Journal of Chickasaw History and Culture. And most of your poems were published in some other publication. So that happens to be the case with the Chickasaws. Now, you also include stories where I think, gosh, that must be Ibi talking here. And I'm thinking right now of a poem about the times you, I'm saying the poet now, the poet has cried. And I think you know what poem I'm talking about. And the title of this poem in itself is emotion provokes emotion. The few times I have cried, and this one happened to have also been published in the American Journal of Poetry. Yeah. So would you read that one for us?
Yeah. The few times I've cried, not for my father's funeral, when that friend died at 17, I was laid off from work when we were already bruised. Every job offer was half the pay. I worked 80 hours each week to try to find the way back from fragile. You said we'd be okay. That night, while you were all asleep, I paused at the car door before leaving for work to listen to geese labor through a no moon, starred dark. A few clouds dizzied our distance. Their wings coughed out cold sky. I worried about you and the kids and whether the car I stood next to would be repossessed in the parking lot of my work while I posed inside. Walking outside work to see the car gone. The walk home. About feeding our kids. About you leaving. That night, standing outside the car, after the birds had gone, we became cloud, then rain. And those birds. Those birds flying at night the wrong way through winter.
Now, this somewhat echoes the title of your collection, Birds at Night, and this last line, those birds flying at night the wrong way through winter. And, you know, I think the person reading this poem can't help but wonder, was that true for you?
Yeah, so some of the poems are like you mentioned. It's really nice to be in a collection and then keep the reader kind of guessing, you know, which is true, what isn't. And this one, you know, did happen. And I had an amazing mentor at the Institute of American Indian Arts. It was my first mentor. I had lots of amazing mentors there. But he read one of my poems, and he said his feedback was like, Ivy, you have like three poems in this six lines of poetry. And of course, I couldn't see it. You know, I'm just starting off as a student. And it happened to be, it was a different poem, but I learned from, there's two title poems called Birds at Night.
Yes.
In this collection. And then this one kind of stems off from that one, too. It's just going deeper into the images and the background and the history of the original poem, which is the shortest Birds at Night. And then, you know, what I learned from him was to expand on that. And, you know, I don't just have to be so abstract and so, you know, because we learn from reading and we learn from looking at other poets. And, you know, I was kind of raised up in the era of kind of abstract poetry where it's more of a riddle. You know, yes. You kind of like have to really decipher it, and, you know, but I realized.
And sometimes think, well, that's what the poet was feeling, but I don't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas this one, I think, so sad to say, so many people reading this would think, oh my gosh, I can identify with this. I didn't cry at my father's funeral. I know people who didn't even want to go to their father's funeral.
Well, and a crazy, because there's a lot of other, like you said, poems in here, and there's a lot of like father poems in here. And so this one tried to tie kind of almost the collection together with a lot of that information. And, you know, a little backstory on that, like, because my father did pass away when I was 15, and I never really knew him. You know, he was, you know, a lot of those poems are kind of true. Like the upon finding a picture of my estranged father holding me, it was a picture I didn't even know existed, you know, and it's of me being held as a baby and he's smiling. And so you can't help but think like, well, what happened from there? You know, like, but I mean, the poem is also very hopeful, I think. And, but when I ended up, when he did pass away, my mother gave me a note to take to the office because I missed the day of school. I was a freshman in high school. And even though I didn't cry at the funeral, I did not give them that note. I crumpled it up and I ended up getting on-campus detention because I missed, it was like a truant day, because I did not want to, you know, break down at school in front of them as they read the note and, you know, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss or whatever it was. So it was just like, you know, and I'm still, of course, trying to write that poem. But I mean, you know, poetry takes time a lot of the time. So sometimes they're really quick, but.
And I think maybe, particularly for men, it seems like women cry more easily, that might be the only time they cry is when their father died.
Yeah.
But this, I think so many people could identify with what you walk home and you worry about feeding the kids, and then you end with birds flying at night. Now, you mentioned a picture of when you were a baby, your dad holding you, and you've written a poem about that. Would you read that for us?
Yes. Upon finding a picture of my estranged father holding me, there I am in the February sun, feeling his gaze. I look only days old. The winter, shadowed behind his shirtless body, cradles me in uncertainty. He shields me from cold. This is what a father feels like. He once held me, wrapped in smile.
This is my guest, Ibi Liebenberg, and he's reading from his collection of poems, Birds at Night. And the poet says, this is what a father feels like. He once held me wrapped in smile. And you say this is nonfiction that you just
wrote. This is definitely nonfiction. It was really interesting because it was just a few years ago, my mother sent me on Facebook Messenger a picture, this picture, and I just looked at it, and I looked at first him holding me with no shirt on outside, and then I looked at me, and I'm like, I look like I'm like a newborn, you know, and then he's holding me and smiling, and then, you know, the picture kind of unravels, you know, your mind kind of wanders, like, well, what happened after that, you know, because I saw him maybe once a year for like the next 15 years, you know, until he passed away. So it was just kind of like.
And where was, this was before you moved to Paradise.
Yeah, we lived in Cherokee, California for about 6 months before we moved to Paradise, yeah. So it was just, and it's really interesting because the more times I read it, the more, I purposely wrote, this is what a father feels like, to be kind of a statement, but also a question, because there's no question mark there, but that's kind of the way I wanted to have it hanging. But the more times I read it, the more it sounds like it's actually hopeful. You know, it's not meant to be a sad moment, you know.
You know what I imagine also is that sometimes I make myself go through a box of photographs that I haven't put in albums, and I stare at a picture that I probably had seen before, but I'm a different person now. And I just imagine if you had seen that picture, say, several years ago versus now, that your reaction to seeing that photograph might evolve and be different at different times.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with these poems. The more times, because this is several years. I mean, this is like 7 years worth of poetry. So, you know, when I reread something, I'm just like, wow, like I completely forgot kind of I wrote that. And,
yes.
You know, because you take so much, you're always like the next poem, the next poem, the next poem. And so it's almost like looking at those pictures, like you mentioned, you know, because you just uncover more meaning because you're a different person. So
my guest is Ibi Liebenberg, and his collection of poetry is entitled Birds at Night. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Ibi Liebenberg, and his collection of poems is entitled Birds at Night. I mentioned that you are a firefighter, and many of us take CPR instructions. I have two from a job. And you have a poem about performing CPR on a dude that looks like my father. Now, once again, this is told in the first person, so we have a poet saying, this guy looks like my father, and I'm guessing, oh, I'll bet that was true.
Yeah, this one was definitely true, and it was just, it was one of those moments that, you know, I always write poems that kind of like are memories that stick out to me that I just can't forget. Or sometimes, you know, you try to repress it. And I was in a grocery store and I saw a person, because my father was very distinct looking. You know, he had long gray hair with a long gray beard and mustache and tall. He was like 6'5" and thin. And so I was in a grocery store and I saw someone that looked like him. And, you know, you kind of do this thing like, you know, he's dead, but it's... And then that triggered my memory of that CPR. And I, in my head, I just, you know, doing CPR. And of course, it started out as some guy who looks like my father, you know. And I was like, well, maybe I can even distance it and, you know, make it a little bit more, you know, because everything in poetry is word choice. I mean, same thing with fiction and nonfiction.
Because you don't have many words to use. You have to choose them carefully.
Yeah. And so... So much time is being spent on, you know, the right word, and you know, I settled on that, and I was just like, well, let's see how it lands, you know. But
okay, well, would you read that that poem about doing CPR on a guy?
Yeah, doing CPR on some dude who looks just like my father, and he has been dead for so many years, I barely recognize him, but for him. I could fake that heart into beating a few more times. Of compressions, I'd breathe for him, press my lips into his, even though it is against protocol. Ribs give under weight, I fall through. In the chaos of the body, I barely knew him anyway. In the ambulance, my hands consent to skin becoming cold, arms practice pushing away. At the hospital, they cannot separate us. So I apologize for the violence of not letting go.
This is poet and Chico State University lecturer Ibi Liebenberg. And he's reading from his collection, Birds at Night. And this sounds like it's you speaking as yourself and not just as a poet.
Yeah, this one's definitely, you know, something that happened, and it's really interesting because this one took a lot of years to write, you know, because you have an experience and you want to share it with the world because it, you know, it meant so much to you also, and it, you know, writing is just more than you. You know, you rely on other people to, you know, give you feedback, you know, and this is one of those because the first half of the poem was pretty much all I had. And then, you know, a few people gave me feedback and they're like, it needs more. It needs to be fleshed out a little bit more. You know, I can't tell you what it needs. But so then that's where the ambulance ride and then the hospital, I finally brought that in and kind of, you know, closed that chapter. So.
And I mentioned that many of your poems have been published elsewhere. And I was interested in where this poem was published in a couple of different places, one in a place named in New Jersey. But then the other one, it was published in a publication whose title is in the Old Norse. Hmm. And so I thought, well, now that's interesting that they would publish a poem like this. But I think this could be understood all sorts of situations. One thing that I found interesting, too, that I've known over the years taking CPR, that in the poem it says, press my lips into his, even though it is against protocol.
Yeah. So, because as first responders, we're not supposed to make any skin contact, any body contact. You know, so we wear gloves. We protect ourselves from any bodily fluid. So, you know, we're not supposed to, even though that was taught, you know.
Was.
So then I, you know, I wanted to put that in there to show that, you know, I, in that moment, you know, I was like really conflicted because, like, if it was my father, of course, you know, I'd do anything I could, you know, to save him. So.
Yeah. Well, you have these experiences as a firefighter in your book, and even you are living in a place, it seems like not too long ago on the national news, I saw news, information about the fire in Paradise. And what you had been living in Paradise when you were a little, from a baby, from 6 months old, you lived in Paradise. Your family home was in Paradise. And it got burned.
Yeah.
And what were your experiences during the campfire?
It was really tough because as a firefighter, I was laid off 3 days before the campfire. So we can only, as a seasonal firefighter, which I still am, it just works best with my schedule and teaching and everything else. It gives me a lot of flexibility is, you know, I timed out and there was probably like 15 others of us that timed out, you know, 3 days before the campfire. And it was just, I remember afterwards, you know, cause I didn't go back to work till February of the next year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
from November to February.
And I just couldn't believe how much of, because we had a lot of rains that winter. And so the cleanup crews couldn't go up and, you know, do a lot of the removal. So just driving around in the engine, you know, going to calls or, you know, or whatever it was, it's just, you know, we have our nice, beautiful engine that's red and it's just, everything is burnt and black and cars are still everywhere. You know, houses are, you know, completely down. And I mean, it just was really a visceral experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately I was, you know, doing writing at the time and, I wrote a few poems about that experience because, you know, there's no way I could go back now and remember those feelings of what it was. And, yeah, it was just, you know.
Well, you use the word visceral because so many of us who live in this area know what you're talking about because we, even if we weren't in Paradise, when we saw it again after the fire, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
Well, would you read us, and you have a poem called This is Paradise After the Campfire.
Yeah, so many of these poems are interesting because sometimes there's a little epigraph after the campfire just to give it, because out of context, if someone just read a poem, This is Paradise, and knew nothing about
the
campfire.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah. And so it's, you really have to kind of pick and choose how you
present it.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. This is Paradise after the campfire. Trees that survived will be taken next. They have suffered so much. I see sky now. Birds that look lost. People glare like we do not belong. Our engine presses a lovely red hue like a flower against the burned earth. We drive down streets no longer named, act surprised when we are lost.
This is my guest, lecturer at Chico State University in the English department, and he has a collection of poems, Birds at Night, and he is I.B. Liebenberg. And this poem, This is Paradise, touches all of us who live in this area, I do believe. This was also published in that same collection of previously published, The Campfire. Now, we've looked at your role as a firefighter and as a son, and as so many different roles that you play, and you we haven't really gotten to we mentioned wolves and coyotes, but you also mentioned flowers, and there's a lot of these changing climates with the animals, and you vary the title of your book, Birds at Night. And two of your poems are named Birds at Night, mm-hmm. and in one of them, the title is capitalized, Birds at Night, and then the second one is not capitalized. And I thought,
Yeah, that was, originally they were both not capitalized. That was kind of like a publication thing. They wanted to be able to vary them because one of my mentors and the director at the time at the Institute of American Indian Arts where I went, he had a collection and he had several poems that were of the same title. There was a collection, in his collection there was probably like 15 poems and 8 of them had the same title. And I was just like, oh, well, he could do it. So, you know what I mean? So that's where I kind of learned that. But in the publication state, they wanted me to change.
Well, why don't you read us the first one? It occurs earlier in your book than the second one. And this Birds at Night was also published in Blue River Review and Poetry Northwest. So this has been published in other publications. Would you read us Birds at Night?
Birds at Night. Overhead, under tired silhouettes, fighting through the almost dark, wings touching black, the blur between stars disappears. The sound of labor and pain against the earth and sky not caring.
This is Ibie Liebenberg reading from his book, Birds at Night, and that poem was entitled Birds at Night. Do you have anything else you want to say about that before we look at the next Birds at Night?
Yeah, this one was more just kind of abstract and detail-oriented, not much context there except for the fact that the speaker is, you know, observing and showing empathy towards another creature that is out there in the night, maybe perhaps having a harder time than they are. And so, you know, just taking notice and appreciation, or at least, you know, that empathy for that creature that's flying around at night, you know.
And the sky doesn't care.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take a look at the later in your collection, Birds at Night with not capitalized title. And this was also published in Poetry Northwest.
Birds at Night. The harass of quiet, wings gathering over the hush of their dark magnified, is midnight, full of loud bodies, the geese lost now, circling 1 a.m. above the trees. My elders say it is a gift to translate these unspeakable things. All I hear is real labor, real pain, in whatever tongue they sing.
And again, the poet reading his poetry is Ibie Liebenberg, and the collection is Birds at Night. So we've had poems where you've drawn on your experience as a firefighter, experience as an enrolled citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, and a son. But you're also, you teach college students. And so, and there's a poem in here that I found amusing because I used to teach college students. Why I love lame excuses from college freshmen. And I remember somebody telling me, he was getting calls, oh, I can't take the test because, and he said, finally, after however many, he said, I don't care if you broke your leg, you better show up in class. Sure enough, this kid comes in on crutches. And so it was true that he had the reason that he gave. But you write a poem, Why I Love Lame Excuses.
Yeah, this one was a very tough one because you get, like you said, all of these different emails, excuses, whatever it is. But every once in a while, you know, a family member dies or... And, you know, it just happens to be, you know, it's not an excuse. And it's, and, you know, relating to that experience of my own like, I don't even know how they come back to class, you know what I mean? And I wondered the same thing for me, you know, when I showed back up to school, you know, you're just numb about it. You don't know how to, you know, anything. So, and then that's where this one came about, so.
And you're referring to when your dad actually died, you had to go back to school.
Yeah, the next day. And just not even wanting them to read the note in front of me, you know, so I didn't even turn it in. I threw it away, you know, just because.
Well, why don't you read us this poem?
Okay. Why I love lame excuses from college freshmen. I hate it when their dads die. Their moms, too. But dad always dies more. So I relate. Trying to sit through class with your bones not there to support you. You dissolve into the desk. Try to disappear. Just tell me your alarm did not wake you. Pull yourself together and forget what day it was, like I did when my dad died.
And again, this is Ibi Liebenberg reading from Birds at Night. And from what you've already told us, when this person's, the first person in this poem can be you, because you said this was really what happened to you.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, like this is pretty much the only one where a teacher won, because it's not that there's not a lot to draw on. It's just, I think a lot of the traumatic experiences, which, you know, I'm definitely trying to write away from too. As a writer, you just kind of write what you know. So, you know, everyone would always, you know, like, oh, you have any more firefighter poems? You have any more of this? And, you know, some of them are about fighting wildland fires in here or whatever else. So it's just, you know, you kind of just draw on your own experiences. And so.
And yours are so varied.
Yeah.
So you could write a collection of poems on any one of your roles that you play in life.
Well, that was the difficult thing with this, is because I don't see myself as a prolific writer. Like, it takes me a long time to write poems. So when I finished with this in school, this is pretty much the collection I had, not in this order, but I was like, I originally had it broken up into three sections of the different, the themes that were happening. And, you know, I sent it out to several different competitions and, you know, didn't hear anything back, you know, not a finalist, not anything. And then so I did one more year of fiction in my program. So I kind of put everything on hold, and then I revisited this. And thankful to my colleagues at Chico State who read through my manuscript, several of them, and kind of listed where they thought my strongest work was. And so I was able to kind of like set a tone for the collection based off of that. And it wasn't, I didn't have to break it up into themes. I just tied all the themes together the best I could. And because otherwise I was thinking, I might have to just have three separate collections here and spend several more years getting more poems on each topic. And, but then, you know, you don't know how long that's going to take. So I was just like, I'm very happy that, you know, I reached out to my peers and, you know, they helped. And, you know, that's, you know, a lot of the instructors at the English department, you know, helped out with that. So I was very appreciative.
After a break, Ibi Liebenberg and I will be back to continue our conversation about his poems in his collection, Birds at Night. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Chico poet Ivy Liebenberg, who is also a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation and a firefighter for the state of California, as well as a lecturer in the English department at Chico State University. I did wonder how you came to organize the themes in your book. And there's so many. Oh, gosh, there were so many that I thought, oh, I'd love for him to read this. In fact, when somebody saw what I was reading, he says, oh, I'd like to read that book. So I hope it's available here in town, like maybe at Josh's the bookstore.
Yeah, it is. I just went in there right before here. I always go into a bookstore and kind of see. And there was one copy that I saw. So it is available next door. So,
because there are a lot of things in here that we poems that I didn't have a chance to get you to read. But maybe is there anything else you would like to add that we haven't touched on yet in our conversation?
Yeah, it's just it is definitely. It's really interesting to learn the writing strategies and what you can use to as your benefit, like you said, where you kind of is this him or is this not him? And it's almost like a way to protect yourself, but also, you know, leave that reader guessing, you know, because at the end of the day it's really important for the reader to be able to not necessarily sometimes input themselves into the piece, you know, like, or have some kind of connection to the piece. And I feel like you touched on it where there's a lot of first person, because I feel like with first person, it's like you, I. So you become the speaker in a sense. And then, but I also play around with that and do some second person. I kind of switch back and forth. And then also with the tenses, like that's one thing that as a writer I've learned to kind of, you know, mess with the tenses to kind of, you know, to play with time and, you know, kind of just to leave it all out there for readers to be kind of, you know, circling in a sense, you know, the time aspect, so...
Well, I wonder if you have an opportunity to teach poetry in your classes at Chico State.
So most of the classes I teach are the academic writing for the freshmen, but we do, I incorporate 1 week of poetry. So we do look at poetry, and then I've always, when I first approached poetry, I was kind of, you know, scared of it. You don't know what to write. So one of the assignments we have is blackout poetry, and they get to use, I bring in a bunch of textbooks, academic writing textbooks, old ones, and they get to tear pages out of them and then make their own meaning out of those words and cross out everything except for the stuff they want. So it's a really great lesson in, you know, editing and word choice, and they're pretty much, and then they're limited to the words on the page. So, and it's one of the assignments that they really love, as far as, because then they don't have to, a lot of times when you're left to all the words in the world, it's kind of hard to create, you know, from those. So it seems to.
Well, I remember when I was a freshman, in high school, freshman college, poetry, I didn't get it. Yeah. There aren't any, like, answers. Yeah. Math, chemistry, you got an answer. And I even went, I saved my required English course till the very end till I was ready to graduate because I still didn't get it. I even went to the professor's office, and he wasn't able to explain it to me. And between undergraduate and graduate, I fell in love with poetry.
Yeah.
I finally got it.
It just takes that one instructor to kind of open your eyes and actually, you know, bring that work to you. And I did the same thing at Buke. I went to community college first, and English was the last class I took, my last required class, because I was scared to death of it.
Ditto.
And when I took another class at Buke College, it was, I don't know if it was poetry or something, but it was with Amy Antongiovanni, and the poetry she brought in.
She's a wonderful person.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the poetry she brought in just blew my mind. And I was like, this is poetry? Yeah. Like, yeah. Okay, I can get on board with this. And so that's what really started my love for poetry is that class.
Well, it wasn't that I was afraid of it, but I just didn't get it. I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And I remember kind of the turning point for me was a French poem called Le Lac. And this poet goes to this lake that he'd last gone to with his loved one, and she had died. And oh my gosh, it made me cry. And I thought, this is what poetry is. Yeah. It makes you feel something. Yeah. And that's what your poems do.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
I appreciate your coming in and telling us about this. And would you encourage people to maybe pick up a pencil and write some poetry themselves?
Definitely. I mean, it is not only, it's therapeutic. I find it, I never meant to be a form of therapy, but I feel like for my mental health, it definitely helps because you're letting it escape your body and it goes onto a page and you can close the page and walk away from it, you know, and I feel, I have a very traumatic job in the fire service.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And a lot of those are just mental images that are stuck with you. But if you're able to develop them on the page and just let go of them, then I can close that page, revisit it later. It kind of, and you can find the, I had an instructor, Patricia Smith, who said, you know, find the beauty in it if you can. Because if you can find the beauty in that, then it's not going to be as, you know, troubling or painful. And so, I mean, those are words that I always take with me, you know, moving forward.
We didn't even get to your poem with PTSD in the title.
Oh, I know.
But, but readers can find their own copy. And maybe it will inspire them to think, gosh, I experienced that. Maybe I can write a poem.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your poetry with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Ibi Liebenberg and his collection of poems, Birds at Night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chico humorist Eric Miller, a.k.a. Etc. Guy, retired from the garbage business and now has time for outdoor pursuits and writing with the North State Writers Group. And now, here's Eric Miller.
Hi, Nancy. This story is entitled Audible Play Leads to Bamboozles, based on a real-life experience, since I write about real life most of the time. Something that is audible is heard, but calling an audible is something to be done. An audible in football changes a play at the line of scrimmage. The quarterback reads the defense, recognizes an opportunity, then calls an audible, a different play than was called in the huddle. For my case, the line of scrimmage was a sidewalk next to the restaurant's outdoor patio. We settled in for a seafood dinner in Florence, Oregon. September was 2 weeks out. For this trip, we visited our oldest daughter who attended the University of Oregon. The dog days of summer along the Oregon coast are a delight. Skies are blue, the pavement is dry, and you actually need sunscreen. My daughter gave me an Oregon hat blazoned with the school's mascot, a duck. Since I was in the neighborhood, I proudly wore it. "Sco ducks," said one fellow as he strolled by. For the uninitiated, SCO is short for let's go. It's how Oregon Duck football fans greet one another. Bankers, grocers, and even hippies say SCO ducks. To not return a SCO ducks is rude and suspect. SCO ducks differentiates real duck fans from duck decoys. "SCO ducks," I smiled back. "That young quarterback is good," my new friend said, stopping the chat. "If the offensive line protects him, he'll do great. He has quite an arm and great receivers, too." I chuckled to myself. It was time for an audible. "You know," I said as I sipped my beer, "even the backup players are good. The depth chart goes four deep, like that Johnson kid." My friend squinted, thinking through the roster. "Johnson? Yep, a running back from Madras." "I wouldn't know. I'm from Portland," said my new friend. "I only follow the Portland area players." I continued, "The backups are talented. They can play at any Division I school, but they chose Oregon. A kid from Bend, a third stringer, is the meanest linebacker around. He's on special teams." "Holloway?" my friend asked. "Nope, it's Williams. Then there's Smith, a backup tight end. I think he's from your area." My friend stared at the sky. "Yeah, Smith. His brother played a few years ago." The one guy that amazes me, though, I baited, is Brown, a free safety from Medford. My friend appeared thoroughly perplexed. Medford? He can play either safety or split end. He'll start someday. You watch. My friend scratched his chin. I need a roster. You sure know duck football. Going to the scrimmage? Not this time, I said. We're touring the coast. The waitress arrived with our dinner. Steam from my grilled cod wafted across the patio. His eyes met mine. You take care, he said as they twinkled. I love talking to Ducks fans. Sco Ducks! We fist bumped. Sco Ducks! My family gaped, aghast. How did you know all that? I didn't know anything, I said. I don't even know who the coach is. What? I didn't want to be rude. The guy wore a team jersey and said, Sco Ducks! But you carried on for 5 minutes. You missed the appetizers. It's easy to fake a football conversation. You only need to know a few positions. Like quarterback? Yeah, but toss out others like running back, linebacker, safety, and tight end. Well, how did you know the names of the third and fourth string players? I didn't. But I do know that the most common American surnames are Smith, Johnson, Williams, and Brown. Where's Miller? You descend from a guy who made flour, right? Miller is number 7. I didn't want to fake 7 positions. So you bamboozled him, they scolded. Not entirely. Only the parts that are untrue. He'll be mad once he figures this out. Hopefully by the time he walks back, we'll be gone. Besides, those are real positions with real names, not just real guys. The art of bamboozling is an important life skill. However, take precautionary note. You can make or lose friends, especially when bamboozling about politics. If you try bamboozling, know something about the topic and also know your audience, or wear track shoes. Election season is upon us. I'll study the issues, the candidates, and will execute due diligence. I'll figure out who's bamboozling me, because, speaking on behalf of all bamboozlers, it takes one to know one. This is Eric Miller.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.